I've entitled this message this morning, What's Your Hurry? How often do we come into the new year and we have this sense of wanting to launch? And that's appropriate at times, right? Every new day we get out of bed, we launch into the day. We launch into the new year too, in different ways. Let me ask you this question. What's your hurry? We live in a world that is building itself increasingly on hurry. A lot of hurry. It was interesting. I'm reading in a book. It's entitled The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry: How to Stay Emotionally Healthy and Spiritually Alive in the Chaos of the Modern World by Mark Comer. And what this gentleman is saying, he's a pastor. What he's saying is what so many of us in church in North America have been experiencing over the last number of years. Hurry is pretty much killing us. It's killing us. We rush. I like to joke sometimes and say, well, my mother was Russian, but I'm just taking my time. The words of Psalm 46. I may have read this last week. I don't even remember now. But some of Psalm 46 says this to us: God is our refuge and strength, always ready to help in times of trouble. So we will not fear when earthquakes come and the mountains crumble into the sea. Let the oceans roar and foam. Let the mountains tremble as the waters surge. I love that. Let them do it. Let the earth collapse around us. Let it happen. A river brings joy to the city of our God, the sacred home of the Most High. God dwells in that city. It cannot be destroyed. From the very break of day, God will protect it. Where does God live now? He lives here. From the break of day, God will protect you. Though things are collapsing around you, though there's chaos in the world, and as Pastor Ken mentioned, even though the start of the year was somewhat chaotic and there's a lot of tentativeness on the world scene, God dwells with us. The nations are in chaos and the kingdoms crumble. God's voice thunders and the earth melts. The Lord of heaven's armies is here among us. The God of Israel is our fortress. Come see the glorious works of the Lord. See how he brings destruction upon the world. He causes wars to end throughout the earth. He breaks the bow and snaps the spear. He burns the shields with fire. Be still and know that I am God. Be still. That's exactly what it means in the Hebrew. Desist from all your scrambling, all of your running to and fro, trying to make things happen. Be still and know that I am God. God is still in control. He's still in control. You may feel like things are out of control, but God is still in control. I will be honored by every nation. I will be honored throughout the world. The Lord of heaven's armies is here among us. The God of Israel is our fortress. What's your hurry? In the book that I just mentioned by Mark Comer, he reiterates a story that probably many of us have heard before in the past, and it goes like this. It's the height of British colonialism. An English traveler lands in Africa intent on a rapid journey into the jungle. He charters some local porters to carry his supplies. After an exhausting day of travel, all on foot, and a fitful night's sleep, he gets up to continue the journey. But the porters refuse. Exasperated, he begins to cajole, bribe, plead, but nothing works. They will not move an inch. Naturally, he asks why. The answer? They're waiting for their souls to catch up with their bodies. That's a picture of us. That's a picture of us, friends. That's a picture of us. Letty Kalman, in her telling of this story, wrote, "This whirling, rushing life which so many of us live does for us what that first march did for those poor jungle tribesmen. The difference? They knew what they needed to restore life's balance. Too often, we do not. We just keep going and going and going, rushing, intent on fulfilling plans that we've crafted in our own minds. We have to make something happen. And we even translate that into our spiritual lives too. We got to please God. We got to get his attention. We want his blessing. So therefore, we got to do something. We got to work. We got to go. We got to serve. We got to make it happen. We somehow got to strive in order to run up to and catch God's goodness and pull it close. But didn't we just sing a song? Your goodness is running after me. And I think God is wanting to come to us and pour out his goodness, but it's like he can't catch us. We're just going so fast from thing to thing to thing. And we filled our calendars with so much. Got to take time in the rush to pause and reflect and to be still and know that God is still God. Terry and I love traveling. We love doing the zoom zoom in our little car from place to place and with friends. And I recall the one really hot summer day we were traveling somewhere in Montana. And we were, I think, going to end up at Great Falls that night, kind of the last night of our trip. And so we're just going down the highway somewhere in Montana. The sun is beating down. It's hot. And I'm thirsty. And I'm just getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And I love going fast. Thumbs up. Lots of thumbs up. Ho, ho. Okay, I'll talk with you guys. All right. But you know what? You can only sustain speed for so long, and then you've got to pull over. Either you'll run out of gas with your car, or you'll run out of gas with your attention span. And that's what was happening to me that day. And I was getting hot, and I was looking for a body of water that we could stop and pull in by and be refreshed. So all of a sudden, we come over this rise, and I see a little river down below, and I make a last-minute decision. I don't know what Norbert was thinking because he was trailing behind me. I jammed on the brakes, geared down as fast as I could, and pulled into this little off-road gravel parking spot, and we stopped. And I just wanted to get to the river. I just wanted to get in the river. And wouldn't you know it, there were some friendly hikers coming along the way. They just wanted to talk. And I'm thinking, just shut up. Let me get to the river already. But we were friendly. We talked for a few minutes. And then we went to the river. And I took my sandals off and I went in the river. And I got right in the river. And I recognized the telltale signs of everything going on around. I didn't care. I just wanted to be still and get in that water. And it was refreshing, even though I was fully aware that cattle went back and forth across that little river at will and all kinds of other wildlife, but I got right in the river. I laid down in the river. I cooled off. Stopped. Paused. Michael Zigarelli from the Charleston Southern University School of Business conducted the Obstacles to Growth survey of over 20,000 Christians across the globe and identified busyness as a major distraction from spiritual life. Listen carefully to his hypothesis. It may be the case that, one, Christians are assimilating to a culture of busyness, hurry, and overload, which leads to, two, God becoming more marginalized in Christians' lives, which leads to 3, a deteriorating relationship with God, which leads to 4, Christians becoming even more vulnerable to adopting secular assumptions about how to live, which leads to 5, more conformity to a culture of busyness, hurry, and overload. And the cycle begins again. And pastors, by the way, he says, are the worst. He rated busyness in our profession right up there with lawyers and doctors. I'm glad that I can say that I have done my best to take time. When I start feeling really tired or really stressed or over busy, I just go away for a bit. I go for a walk. I sit down in a coffee shop. I take a book with me and I just pause. And I've learned to do that, and I'm glad I have. At a very recent pastoral colleague at a recent event, a bunch of us pastors and civic leaders were at this event just before Christmas. And when I came in, I greeted one of my other colleagues. And I said, "Hey, how's it going? How are things?" And he said, "Oh, busy." Surprise. He said, "I've got this lunch engagement right now, and then I should be at 3 other lunches and suppers all today. I just might show up for a few minutes to each one just to say that I was there." And I know that the Christmas season is like that for many of us, right? You've got Christmas parties to go to, Christmas gatherings, New Year's gatherings, all of these things, and we go, go, go. But I've known pastors long enough to know that many of us are in a situation, and again, I've done my best to pull out of that trap, but so many that I speak with, and maybe it's your situation too, when someone asks you, "How's it going?" you say, "Busy. I don't know which end is up. My calendar is so full. I'm running at way below empty, maybe fumes. I don't know how I'm going to manage." Ronald Rollhauser, as someone is writing, his undisputed favorite Catholic writer of all time with Hurricane Force says this: "Today, a number of historical circumstances are blindly flowing together and accidentally conspiring to produce a climate within which it is difficult not just to think about God or to pray, but simply to have any interior depth whatsoever. We, for every kind of reason, good and bad, are distracting ourselves into spiritual oblivion. It is not that we have anything against God, depth, and spirit. We would like these. It is just that we are habitually too preoccupied to have any of these show up on our radar screens. We are more busy than bad, more distracted than non-spiritual, and more interested in the movie theater, the sports stadium, and the shopping mall, and the fantasy life they produce in us than we are in church. Pathological busyness, distraction, and restlessness are major blocks today within our spiritual lives." In the same book, the author writes, "It's often quoted that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results." But that's exactly what we do with our spiritual lives. We get a vision of the kind of life that is possible in Jesus. We go to church or read a book or listen to a podcast. We catch a glimpse of the kind of life we ache for, one of emotional health and spiritual life. Our gut immediately says, "Yes, God, I want that life." We head home from church and all the willpower we can muster and set out to change. But then we go right back to living the exact same lifestyle and nothing changes. We change nothing in our schedule to accomplish or to accommodate the hunger and the thirst that we experience from time to time for God's presence. If we're really that hungry, do we change our schedule and make time to be still and to know that He is God? It's the same cycle on repeat: stress, tiredness, distraction. We feel stuck yet again, and then we wonder, "What am I missing?" This method of change simply does not work. What does? Honestly, he says, the solution is very, very simple. If you want to experience the life to the full that Jesus promises, his nonstop conscious enjoyment of God's presence and world, all you have to do is adopt not only his theology and ethics, but also his lifestyle. Just follow his way. And that's when Jesus speaks to us as would-be apprentices, as disciples. And he says to us, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart. And you will find rest for your souls. That's what those African tribesmen were doing. They were pausing. They were not going another foot that day until their souls caught up with their bodies. Do we have the freedom to say to the people we work for from time to time, listen, I can't take in all that information. I can't process stuff that fast. You got to give me a little more time, because my soul needs to catch up with my body. To be one of Jesus' disciples is to apprentice under Jesus. It's to organize your life around three basic goals: to be with Jesus, to become like Jesus, and then do what he would do if he were you. The whole point of apprenticeship or discipleship is to model all of your life after Jesus, and in doing so, to recover your soul. Because honestly, for most of us, our soul is way out of balance. Way out of balance. And as we begin this year, if we are intent on being a family of faith that experiences ongoing revival, part of that is bringing into alignment again the pace of our lives. Now, some people, I get it, are gifted by God with an extraordinary amount of energy, and they can do many, many, many things often, one after the other, after the other, and keep everything compartmentalized and flow. God gives that to some people, and I know some of you in this room. But most of us need to pause and we need to process. What did we just do? What difference did it make? Where might God lead me next? And by the way, where does my family fit into all of this? To experience what Jesus called life to the full, what the New Testament writers call salvation, right? Keep in mind the Greek word that we translate salvation is soteria, and it's the same word we translate as healing. When you read in the New Testament and you read that somebody was healed by Jesus, and then you read somebody else was saved by Jesus, you're reading the same Greek word most often. That says something to us. Salvation is healing. Even the etymology, it's a big word, talks about language versus uses of words, of our English word salvation comes from the Latin salve. So often, especially in the wintertime when it gets really dry, I see this repeated many times. Whether it's here on a Sunday morning, whether it's in a coffee shop, whether it's at home, people all of a sudden realize, oh, my hands are getting chapped. They dig around in a purse or a pocket, little blab of some kind of stuff, and to be refreshed in the hands, right? That's what we do. An ointment, the salve you put on a burn or a wound also. And this is what Jesus was all about, healing people, saving them, at a soul deep level. How? Through apprenticeship, through discipleship to him and his ways. So everywhere Jesus went, he was constantly offering an invitation. Usually it sounded like this, come, follow me. Come, follow me. In the busyness of your day and your life, Jesus says to you, even today, as you begin the world, as you begin 2020, Jesus is the one saying, come follow me. That's why as pastors we're getting away next week. We want to get our heads and our hearts together and trust that Jesus is going to speak to us saying, come follow me. I want to speak to you guys. I know you got all kinds of good plans, boys. Some of them are mine from me to you, but some of them, you got to just go like this. Because I want you to follow me. And he does that with every one of us. Come follow me in 2020. What's your hurry? I think what God is saying to me is, yeah, be in a hurry, but be in a hurry to be still. And build that into your life at regular intervals. We're going to watch a video, just over 20 minutes long, then we're going to share communion together. But this is solid teaching, and I want you to hear this. It comes from a pastor's heart to our life of our schedules today. Let's watch this.
You know, life has a lot of different ways to teach us about what matters the most. And I want to tell you about one of my favorite ways. I am standing on the world's largest Monopoly board. It's located in downtown San Jose, just a few miles away from where I live. And it's not just a decoration. This actually is a playable Monopoly board. I haven't played much Monopoly in recent years, but I used to play a lot when I was growing up. And if we'll let it, Monopoly has something profound to teach us about life's most important lesson. I learned it from my grandmother, because my grandmother taught me how to play the game. Let me tell you about my grandmother. My grandmother lived with us when I was growing up as a kid, and she was a wonderful person. She used to tell great ghost stories. She was a great cook. She would make banana bread and this dessert called red velvet cake. It's mostly butter. She would pop popcorn on Friday nights in bacon grease and then put the bacon bits in the popcorn. It was fabulous. Nobody in my grandmother's family lived to be too old, but we love my grandmother. She was a wonderful person, but she was the most ruthless Monopoly player I have ever known. Imagine what would have happened if Vince Lombardi had married Lady Macbeth, maybe, and they had a kid. And you get some sense of the way that my grandmother played Monopoly. When the game would start, I would get my $1,500 and I'd want to hold on to it. But my grandmother understood that acquisition is necessary to win, that money is how you keep score. And so eventually, inevitably, my grandmother would become master of the board, buy every piece of property she landed on, mortgage that, and acquire everything else. And I would always land on her property once too often, and I would have to give her my last dollar and quit in utter defeat. And then she would say to me, don't worry about it, Johnny, one day you'll learn how to play the game. And I always hated it when she would say that. And then one summer, I was about 10 years old, and I played with a neighborhood kid, and I learned that summer how to play the game. It gradually dawned on me, money's how you keep score. You gotta acquire everything you can. And by the time that fall rolled around, and I was going to play my grandmother again, I was more ruthless than she was. I was ready to bend the rules if I had to beat my grandmother. I played her with sweaty palms. Relentlessly, inexorably, I drove her off the board. Slowly, with great cunning and skill, I exposed the soft underbelly of my grandmother's vulnerability. I can still remember it happened at Marvin Gardens. And I looked at my grandmother. She was an old lady by now. She was a widow by the time I knew her well. She had raised 6 children. She raised my mom. She loved my mom. She loved me. And I took everything she had. I destroyed her financially and psychologically. I beat my grandmother and watched her give me her last dollar and quit in utter defeat. And then I had one more lesson to learn. Because the great lesson always comes at the end of the game. And I first heard this from James Dobson, who talked about a time when he learned at playing Monopoly with his family. The great lesson at the end of the game is this: when the game is over, it all goes back in the box. All that money, all that property, all those houses, all those hotels, Boardwalk and Park Place, everything, when the game is over, goes back in the box. I didn't want everything to go back in the box. I wanted to leave everything out as a kind of perpetual memorial to my great skill. This is the great lesson of life. When the game is over, all the stuff goes back in the box. And so you have to ask yourself, how should I play the game in light of this one great truth? The psalmist says in Psalm 90, teach us to number our days aright so that we can gain a heart of wisdom. It's a funny thing. Almost everybody I know has really good intentions in life. People want to know God well. They want to do good work. They want to develop good character. They want to have great relationships. They want to be really good parents. And yet we find ourselves drifting into another mode. When Nancy and I had 2 children and they were real small, we were on a plane one time doing a long cross-country flight. We'd taken over the back row of the plane. Nobody else wanted to be near us because it didn't look good, it didn't smell good, it was littered with dirty diapers and crayons and crackers and crumbs. You know you're in trouble when the flight attendant says, would you mind if your kids played outside? And we were wondering, why did we bring these kids with us on this trip? Why did we have these kids in the first place? And then a guy a couple rows in front of us turned around and surveyed the damage. And he looked at me and he said, are those your 2 kids? And I thought about it. And I said, yes, they are. And he said, my wife and I would give anything in the world to have 2 kids. I said, you don't have any kids? He said, no, we have 5 kids. We'd give anything in the world to have 2 kids. It's part of the human condition. We have all these dreams for the kind of people we want to be, the kind of lives we want to live, the kind of work we want to do, the kind of families we'd like to raise. And yet we find our lives getting away from us. We do not number our days aright. We forget the one great lesson. And so God calls us back to it over and over again. In Jerusalem, Jewish people from all over the world would come over the years and build synagogues. And there's one synagogue there that has a coffin that's built into the wall. And when people ask why it is there, they are told that in the Talmud we are taught that each human being is to repent one day before they die, the day before the last day of their life. And everybody will ask, well, how do I know what's going to be the day before I die? And then they're told, we are to live every day as if it is the day before our last day. We are to live every day in light of the great truth that it's all going back in the box. And so I must arrange my life around what matters most. And I know so many wonderful people who have such good dreams, but they just drift into living their lives around things that are only temporal, things that cannot bring satisfaction, things that do not really matter to God. My grandmother, in many ways, lived a pretty simple life. She raised 6 children, 3 boys first, Hack, Jack, and Mac, believe it or not, and then 3 girls, including my mom. She never traveled a great deal. She never wrote a book. She never had a job outside the home I know of, except working at a little bakery in Rockford, Illinois. But none of that mattered much to her, because she understood what was temporal and what's eternal. She understood what matters a lot and what's not so important. She remembered this one great lesson that when the game is over, everything is going back in the box. And that's the lesson that some of the smartest people in the world forget. There was a man named Jesus who told one of his most unforgettable stories about just such a smart guy. But that one, I want to tell you about someplace else. Jesus told a story, I'll give it to you in modern terms, of a busy guy. He was committed to success, whatever success took, and it took everything. He'd work 12 or 14 hours a day, joined boards of directors to be able to meet people who could help him climb the ladder. His wife would nag him sometimes about his family. He knew the kids were growing up and he was kind of missing it. From time to time, they would complain about games they weren't playing or lunches they weren't eating together, but after a while, they stopped complaining because they stopped expecting it would ever be any different. He'd bring his briefcase home from work every night, and this troubled his son. Son finally asked him, "Dad, how come every day you come home, you always bring your briefcase?" And his dad said, "Well, son, it's because I can't get all my work done at the office." And his son said, "Dad, couldn't they put you in a slower group?" But he was not big on the slower group deal. One night he went to bed, about 1 o'clock in the morning, he woke up and he felt a twinge in his chest. And his wife made an appointment for him to see the doctors. They told him that he had all the classic symptoms, high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, and he would need to make some significant changes in his lifestyle. For a little while he did, but after his symptoms went away, his motivation to change went away also. He would often say to himself, "This man, there'll be plenty of time to be with my kids. There'll be plenty of time to enjoy my family. There'll be plenty of time to take care of my body in 6 months or so when things settle down." And although he was a very bright guy, this man in Jesus' story, he never seemed to notice that things never actually settled down. He knew his life was kind of out of balance. There was a church down the street from them, and his wife had talked to him sometimes about being involved there. But Sunday morning seemed like it was the only time he could crash. Besides, he said, "There'll be plenty of time for God in 6 months or so when things settle down." And then one day, a remarkable thing happened in the life of this man in Jesus' story. The COO of his company came to him and said, "You know, you're not gonna believe this, but we're on the brink of an economic miracle. We got orders coming in so fast, our supply can't even keep up with demand, and if we catch this wave, we'll be set for life. This is it, this is the dream. But we got headaches too. We got inventory problems and our software is outdated, and if we don't make some changes around here, we could be in trouble." Now, from that moment on, this man in Jesus' story is like a man possessed. Every waking moment is devoted to this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And then it hits him. He could reorganize everything. He could tear down all of the old structures of his company and put up newer, bigger structures. He could put his company through a technological revolution, and they could go wireless and paperless. And he went home that night, and he said to his wife, "You know what this means, don't you? When I have finished this project, I will have climbed the ladder to the top rung. I will have achieved the dream, financial security. We can finally relax." She'd heard that kind of talk before, so she didn't get too excited. She went up to bed at 11 o'clock. She asked him, "You want to come on up with me?" And he said, "No, I'll be there in a couple of minutes. I want to get a little more work done on my computer. You go ahead." About 3 o'clock in the morning, she woke up, and his side of the bed was still empty. So she went downstairs to bring him up. His head was resting on his arm in front of his computer terminal, and she went to touch him on the shoulder to bring him to bed, but his skin was cold when she touched it, and he did not respond to her voice. She got a panicky feeling in the pit of her stomach. She called 911, but by the time the paramedics got there, they told her that he had had a massive heart attack and had been dead for hours. His death was a major story in the financial community. And because of his prominence, he was written up in the Wall Street Journal and Forbes. And it's too bad he was dead, because he would have loved to have read what they wrote about him. And then they had a memorial service. And again, because of his prominence, the whole community turned out. They all filed past his casket, and they all said the same stupid thing that people always say at funerals when they view the body. "He looks so peaceful." Well, rigor mortis will kind of do that to you. And then people got up to eulogize him at the service that they had. One of them said, he was a visionary. He was an entrepreneur. He was a leader. Somebody else noted all of his technological innovations. They said he was a developer of new delivery systems. He was creative. And then somebody else got up and said, you know, nobody ever caught him cheating on his expense account or his taxes or his wife. He was a straight arrow guy. Somebody else got up and said, he was kind of a pillar in the community. He knew everybody. He was a networker. And because of his prominence, they erected a memorial to this guy, this busy, admired, wealthy, successful, family-neglecting, God-ignoring life. And they wrote on that marker all of these fabulous words: leader, visionary, innovator, networker. And at the top of the marker, they wrote the big word, the word that this man and many other people in our world will sell their soul for: success. And when it was night and everybody had gone home, unseen, unheard, the angel of God came to the cemetery and made its way to this memorial and traced with a single finger the one word that God chose to summarize this man's life: fool. You fool, God says to this man. This night your soul will be required of you. It's a fascinating detail in Jesus' story when he uses that language, will be required. It was taken from the financial arena in his day. And Jesus is saying, nothing you got, not the beat of your heart, not your own soul, really belongs to you. It belongs to God, and one day will come due. Now, who's going to get all of those things you stored up for yourself? He was a really bright guy, the man in Jesus' story. He learned to play the game, played it really well. He just forgot this one detail, that sooner or later the game would end. The game always ends. And that when the game is over, all the stuff goes back in the box. And then Jesus closes his story with one unforgettable sentence. So it is, he says, for every human being who stores up things for themselves but are not rich toward God. Now, the sobering news is, I don't know, and you don't either, that you can ever become rich in the stuff of this world. Doesn't really matter, because when the game's over, it's all going to end up in the same place. But the good news is, it is possible for you, for me, for anybody, to be rich toward God, to be rich in the eyes of God. And this is not a complex deal. Jesus spells this out quite clearly as well. He says it's all about two things: loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and then loving people, loving your neighbor as you love yourself. To love God means that I come to enjoy him, to worship him, to serve him, to delight in him, to be with him. Because when you love somebody, the primary way that gets expressed is in the desire to be with one another. And I can do that with God in quite simple ways. When I wake up in the morning, I can just whisper a prayer: God, would you be with me? Would you walk with me through this day, whatever happens? When I sit down to have breakfast in the morning, I can remember that just as the food is nourishing my body, so the presence of God with me can nourish my soul, my spirit, all through the day. When I drive my car, I can do that remembering that Jesus is right there with me, maybe a little scared in the car. When I go to work, when I am with friends, all through the day, I can remember, I can invite. Every moment is an opportunity to be with Jesus and to learn from Jesus how to be like Jesus. And then fundamental to loving God is loving the people who mean so much to him that he puts in my life. And each moment is just a sacred opportunity to do that. I'm very aware of that right now because on the day that we're filming this, tomorrow, my wife and I will take our youngest child, our son, to college. And it seems to me like the years have gone so fast. Nance was at the grocery store the week after our second daughter went off to college, and it kind of hit her by surprise. Nance was getting potatoes for a meal we'd have later on that week, and what struck her was she only got 3 potatoes. So she thought, we used to be a 5-potato family. And then one of our potatoes went away, and then another one went away to college, and now we're down to 3 potatoes. And she got so choked up, she started to cry in the vegetable department of the supermarket. So then she went, got a packet of Hostess Ho-Hos, ate them, and felt much better after that. But the reality is, we get those potatoes, we get those people in our lives for such a brief window. The psalmist said, teach us to number our days aright, so that we gain a heart of wisdom. And if we do, if you love God, if you love the people that he puts in your life, you and I can be rich toward God, which is the only kind of richness that counts. Because all the other kinds, they're gonna end up here. They're going back in the box.
Let's have the servers come forward.